morning. I'm Allison Bechtesh, and this is Aspen Public Radio's coverage of the Aspen Ideas Festival from the Aspen Institute. Coming up, a broadcast of Building a Water-Secure Future. Water is perhaps the world's most precious and health-sustaining resource, and surely one most at risk. Microbes, lead, and other contaminants threaten access to clean and safe drinking water. Record-breaking droughts and catastrophic floods put burdensome pressure on agriculture and imperil crops. In the face of these challenges, leaders are stepping up to reimagine water systems and solutions. They are promoting green infrastructure to build back thriving wetlands and forests and manage stormwater runoff, engaging the community to protect wells and reviving indigenous water management strategies. Is it enough to secure a sustainable water future? Support for this broadcast of the Ideas Festival comes from Obelmeyer Wood Investment Council, an independent investment advisor committed to helping clients navigate life's financial decisions. Learn more about the firm's team and approach at obelmeyerwood.com. You can see the full schedule of our live broadcast from the Aspen Ideas Festival online, aspenpublicradio.org. Listen later today to hear another broadcast from the 2018 Aspen Ideas Festival titled Leading on Climate. The United States gave up the reins. Now what?
I want to thank Aspen and Spotlight Health for the vision to be able to think about water as a part of the discussion of health. I think many of you might have seen this, the movie A River Runs Through It, but think about water in the middle of all of these issues. I run an organization called Forest Trends, and we work on forest conservation globally, but water runs through the middle of what we do too, and it links us into issues of health. So it's very appropriate that Spotlight Health likes to think of themselves as health out of the box, and we're going to be talking about water out of the box this morning. So we have three great speakers, and the way we're going to run this is we'll have each of them talk for about 5 minutes, their experiences. Then we'll have a bit of a conversation amongst us, and then we're going to open it up so everybody can have a chance to talk about these important issues. Our first speaker, I'm really delighted, Tallulah Oni is with us. She's currently at Oxford University, but Cambridge University. Oh, that's a big boo-boo. The other one. That's the other one. She couldn't get into Oxford, so she's at Cambridge. But she spent, she's a public health physician and was based for about 15 years in Cape Town. So we think about water and, of course, the recent events of the challenges that Cape Town faced in terms of water that are ongoing. But so Tallulah, please start.
Thank you. Good morning, everyone. Great. Lively audience. So thanks, Michael, for the introduction. So as he mentioned, I've just come from Cape Town, where I've been for a while. I've been an associate professor at the School of Public Health there, and has anyone been to Cape Town? Yeah, okay, great. So they are even if you haven't been, right, the very well-known characteristics of Cape Town, the natural beauty, the Table Mountain, and the beaches, pristine beaches, the vineyards just, a stone throw away from the city. It's really, I highly recommend it. But I'm going to focus and set the scene a little bit differently on different characteristics of Cape Town that are perhaps a little bit less well known, and I'll do it using 3 Ds. 1, diarrheal season, didn't see that coming. 2, disparities, and 3, drought. Okay, so with the drought, I think this made the news a few months ago, but actually it's a story that has been playing out for a long time. So when I first moved to Cape Town, over a decade ago, I never it was never communicated, and I never felt water as a scarce resource. It's used rather liberally. It's a very cheap resource, etc. And the current drought has been treated as if it was a recent thing. But in fact, 20 years ago, and we realized this in December, there was a water academic at the University of Cape Town who ran some models and got really frustrated because he couldn't get the attention of policymakers. And so he went to the media, and there was a headline that said, if we don't do something, Cape Town will run out of water in 20 years. Fast forward 20 years and a month, you know, when you don't want your models to be correct. So it's something that's been playing out for a long time, and I think it really shows the discrepancy between what we know in terms of the trends and water as a resource and how we've actually been responding to it, both from the individual level in terms of our consumption patterns through to the strategies and policies put in place to manage this resource. Second is diarrheal season. So bringing it to, I'm a public health physician, bringing it to connecting to water. South Africa is a middle-income country. Cape Town is quite a wealthy city. Despite this, every year, we have what is come to be known and accepted as a diarrheal season. Think about that for a moment. Every year, about the same time, we know that under fives are at risk from diarrhea. And we had rollout of the rotavirus vaccine, which did a lot towards reducing the mortality from diarrhea. But still, the incidence, the number of cases of diarrhea in under fives is persistent. Why is that? In a city that is relatively well-resourced. Relates to the water, both the access to water for quite a significant part of the population, but also the quality of water they have access to. So this is in the context of where the city is most rapidly growing. So in the more adaptive, what is often thought of as informal aspects of the city, where tenure is more insecure, and so where we have floods every year that then further compromise access to water and sanitation in those parts of the city. So as a result, we have these this annual season. And the last D is a disparity. And I think both in terms of the drought and the diarrhea, it's really come to highlight the significant disparities or inequities in terms of the access to unsafe water and sanitation and unsafe urban exposures, if you like, to in different parts of the population. So I'm a public health physician, and I work in urban health, and I see a city, and I don't see buildings, I see exposures, right? So that's my fault, and I see urban exposures that influence health. So if we think about the context of the city, because this is where they're rapidly going, how can we look at improving health and addressing these disparities in a way that actually target the exposures and determinants that are upstream that actually cause these in the first place. And what we know is that most of those lie outside of the health sector. And so as physicians, we like to say we know that the majority of factors that influence health lie outside of the health sector. And then we go back to the clinic. So I set up my research initiative for Cities Health Inequity essentially to look outside of the health sector and to say, well, if we know this is what is driving health or driving ill health, can we move from studying disease to actually looking at how we can create health and create health equally? So I'll pause there because we'll circle around back to some of the strategies that we can look to addressing.
That's great. Maybe say a little bit about, I mean, everybody here has probably been following the day zero kind of phenomena. Where do we sit with that?
Right. So that was interesting. So again, as I mentioned, it hadn't been treated as a scarce resource. And then we realized that for the third winter in a row, there was no rain. And so if we didn't address consumption patterns, we would run out of water. And so then this is what made the news. The first major city to run out of water is going to be Cape Town. There was a date that was identified, the 7th of April, I think it was. And it was incredible the impact that had on consumption. So I was actually away out of Cape Town for some of that time, and I came back shortly before it was day zero, and I was astounded as to how things had changed in terms of how the social norm had changed in terms of how water is being used, such that then, you know, you wouldn't publicly water plants unless you showed that you were using grey water, you know, you put it into, and it was something around, well, 2-minute showers. So everyone, there was a competition around, you know, how short your shower could get. The city had a recommended limit of 50 litres per day. And so this is what made the news, and everyone's talking about how close to 50 litres they made it. But then in some parts of the city, people thought, do we have 50 litres now? Has it gone up? Somehow improved access? So, and I think this goes to show that sometimes, you know, these issues have been there for a long time, but they get airplay when a certain part of the population is affected. Whereas in reality, quite a significant proportion of the population
are always affected.
Has not had 50 litres of water a day. So actually they were wondering whether, you know, should we be using more water now? So I think it was really interesting, the impact of day zero, and it really did reduce consumption quite significantly, such that then the day zero was pushed back a month, then pushed back 6 months, and then now it's sometime next year, and now the rains have come. And what will be interesting now to see is whether...
Do we remember?
Is whether we remember... and I think when we circle back, we'll also talk. I'd like to touch on systems approaches and thinking about how we think about water as part of a planetary resource. Because what's happening now is we've all patted ourselves on the back for reducing our water consumption, and now a couple of desalination plants have kicked in, which are very high intensive energy usage, and we're also an energy scarce setting. Yeah. So we'll come back to how we look at not looking at things in isolation, and also not looking at how to intervene and solve some of these water issues in isolation of the, if you like, the water, food, energy nexus.
Great. Yeah. So we'll be exploring that as we go through this panel for sure. And I really appreciate the distinction that you bring out, which is when we think about water security, there's a water equity issue that's very, very much a part of that issue. So kind of moving up the landscape, if we were, our next speaker, Radhika Fox, I'm very delighted to have met her. I've heard a lot about her organization, the U.S. Water Alliance, and she's an incredible leader of it, has a background in social justice, as well as working actually in the water utility sector in San Francisco. And Radhika, talk a little bit about, so we've been talking about a very urban setting, obviously water throws through a landscape. Take us on that journey with you.
Yeah, I want to start with my personal journey, actually, of how an advocate for social and economic justice is running a national water organization, and how Tallulah, as a public health physician, is now focused on water. So, you know, my story around water really begins in India. So I spent the first 5 years of my life, my grandmother raised me, very rural village, and had very modest latrines for our wastewater systems, and our drinking water was from wells. And when the monsoons came, because there were dirt roads, everything would flood, and so you stayed in the village till the monsoons were done, and you planned for that, et cetera. And, you know, so when I was about 5, I then came here to America, but spent my summers going back and forth to see my grandmother. And so I think at a very early age, really understood how access to water, but also the infrastructure, the systems that bring clean and safe water to homes and businesses, takes that wastewater away and treats it and returns it to the environment, how that's it is a health issue, but it also is fundamentally what has created economic opportunity in this country and healthy communities and the environment and all of the things that we care about. You know, as Michael mentioned, my roots are in advancing and building healthy communities of opportunity. So I have worked before being in water for many, many years on health equity. And, you know, Tulalu, you were talking about how, you know, this and I think it's exciting that we have this transformation that's happening in the health sector where it's not only about treating the patient mm-hmm. and treating the disease, right? But an awakening to the fact that your zip code, right, is your biggest predictor of your health outcomes, more so than your race, more so than your income. Where you live is a proxy for opportunity. And so if we're going to think about health, we have to think about the built environment. We have to think about communities. And so I was doing that work from a transportation perspective, from a housing, land use. And for me, water, I didn't think about it, right? I work domestically here where, you know, we really take our water systems for granted. I mean, recent very visible crises like Flint, Michigan is starting to change that for the American consciousness. But for the most part, we turn on the tap and clean water comes out. We flush the toilets, it goes away, and we're done. We move on. And but, you know, so at the U.S. Water Alliance, we really believe that water is really one of the defining issues of our time here in this country and globally. And that, you know, similar to the health sector where we've had this siloed approach of, you know, you treat the patient, you treat this particular condition with this particular drug, right? We've done the same thing in the water sector, right? We have managed our drinking water system and our wastewater system and our stormwater and our, you know, our groundwater, and we haven't thought about the interdependencies, and we've tried to engineer all of the solutions, right? So the U.S. Water Alliance, with many, many partners all around the country, we're really trying to drive a transformation in how we think about water. It is our most essential resource. We call the approach that we think we need one water, where we have to not only value the resource, right, whether it's drinking water, wastewater, stormwater, whatever it might be, but we have to think about the multiple benefits that we can create for our communities when we invest correctly. And we have to break down all of these silos. I mean, you know, here in this country, we have over 30 agencies at the federal government that have some narrow authority over some piece of our water. And so you can't actually get to the best outcomes for communities when you silo it that way. And so we'll get more into it, I think, Michael, but thinking about the watershed and the interdependencies between the choices that we're making, you know, what we're doing around agriculture and farming and how that impacts our water sources, these issues of equity, well, I know we'll come back to them, but that's a little bit about the alliance and what we're trying to achieve.
Good morning, you are listening to Aspen Public Radio. Thanks for tuning in for our broadcast from the Spotlight Health Conference, Building a Water Secure Future. Water is perhaps the world's most precious and health-sustaining resource, and surely most at risk. Is enough being done to secure a sustainable water future? We return to the talk in just a moment. Thanks for listening.
such an important point that just like in the health sector, in the water sector, you struggle with this idea of silos, and you think about the governance around water, and you have, you know, groundwater, surface water, wastewater, stormwater, all of these with different agencies. And it's not just in the United States. We work all over the world, and it's the same thing. You have 30 different agencies. So, of course, you can't solve the problem because you can't get it all together because we're not seeing it as an ecosystem. And so that's really a kind of a fundamental transformation that we look forward to working with you on and making that happen. And then I'm going to turn it over to Marta Echeverria, who's a great friend and collaborator, who is with Ecodecision based out of Quito, Ecuador. And we have been working together over a decade, and part of what we're working on is this idea that, so think about water not only as it comes out of the tap, but think about water where it comes from to come to your tap. And here sitting where we are in Colorado, of course, we're all sensitive to us. So that brings us back to our part of the equation, which is forests and conservation. That is where the water comes from, and many times the water sector completely forgets about that piece of the equation. But Marta, por favor.
Thank you. Well, thank you all for being here at 8 a.m. But thank you to Spotlight Health and especially Peggy Clark for having us here. And I always like to begin by asking that question. How many of you really know where your water comes from? Raise your hand. That's pretty good. You know, usually we get less of
them. They're here at 8 a.m.
Exactly.
To talk about water.
Exactly. And the question is also, how much did you pay last month for your water? Just give us a number.
I think my bill was $45.
You think 45?
Hardly $2 or $3 in like 200 Pakistan rupees.
Okay.
Wow.
How about you? Okay,
150,
right? So good. So you all do remember, because mostly when you ask that question, people are like, I don't know, you know, but you ask them about their cell phone, they immediately know how much they pay. So that's kind of the work that we do, which is really highlighting how there is something beyond, you know, the water intake and something beyond the water discharge. Because as conservationists, we've been focusing on conservation. And in particular, we have found that water is not priced correctly, right? Especially because of the environmental piece, right? All those externalities, somebody else has to pay for it. And usually it's the health sector, right, that is paying for those externalities. So in the end, everybody ends up paying for them. So in action, we were talking yesterday with the panel, inaction is something that is very real. We're already paying all these costs by omission. So a lot of our work is to begin to say, let's internalize a lot of those costs. In particular, in the drinking water sector, it's not a practice to include the environmental costs. It's always been something that, you know, is managed by another agency. In the U.S., it's the U.S. Forest Service that might do some investment in the watershed. In Australia, it might be an authority that was created to manage that. But the interesting thing is that we've been generating, with Forest Trends and other partner organizations, a discussion with the water utilities to begin to incorporate some of these costs. And we're very proud to say that after work with many people, because it's not a one organization job, we've been able in 2015 to have in Peru the approval of the a law where the environmental compensation was incorporated. So right now, 23 of the 50 utilities in Peru are incorporating in their water tariff the investment upstream. That means that the agency, the utility, can spend money beyond their system, their distribution system, which is a big legal barrier in many countries. And it also means that you begin to have a conversation with those communities that live in upstream, which are usually the poorest of the poor. They're the older people that did not move to the cities. They're the older people that are still having a much more traditional lifestyle, and they're not incorporated so much into the economies. So it's an opportunity to also give back to those communities upstream And also solve their health problems. Many of them have, you know, very bad quality of life statistics. So it's very interesting to begin to have this conversation, because all of a sudden in the Latin American space, when a utility and a regulator is discussing these issues, which we now address them as natural infrastructure issues, we're beginning to get a much larger debate about the role of the utilities, the role of the water users in terms of the watershed, in terms of those ecosystems that we need to protect to ensure the viability of the resource. The same thing has gone on with South Africa, Lima, for example. I don't know how many of you saw in the news. The problem in 2017 was the floods, which basically crashed the system. And you actually had people in Miraflores, San Isidro, the fancy neighborhoods of the city, in line trying to get water because they didn't have water for 5 days. So some of the cisterns ran out, so the people had. And it was really the first time that you had these, where they really, what is a common situation for a lot of the lower income neighborhoods, it becomes very important, you know, it occurs in the neighborhoods where usually people don't even think about what their water bill is or what the water system is. Having said that, we're currently now working in this. We'll talk about the strategies, but in particular, Forest Trends, with my organization and other partners, we just have begun a large USAID-funded project. Also, the Canadian government has come on board to begin to say, how do we get these 50 utilities in Peru to mobilize these resources effectively? Because it's not only the quality of the investment that we need to do, but also to ensure that it goes at the rate that we need to do. So we have the challenge to try to invest $130 million in the next 4 years, really three, which is a huge number. Exactly. It's a good problem to have. I'm not denying it. But it is a challenge, because you do not have the utilities with environmental people in their place. We don't have the monitoring systems. We don't have the bureaucratic weight to be able to channel these resources effectively. And as most of you know, if you don't spend it in a year, the federal government or the central government says, oh, you didn't spend it, we take it away, right? So it is a large challenge that this project has taken on. The project is called Natural Infrastructure for Water Security, and we're very proud to have begun this, which we see not only important for Peru, but really a showcase for other Latin American countries, and why not even for the U.S. and Africa and other and Asia, because we can showcase how this can be done effectively, and now we can move, you know, and make it a mainstream. So that you guys, whenever anybody asks, you know what river your water comes from, you know what ecosystem your water comes from, and you might even know how much it costs to ensure that you have water every time you open the tap.
Great. Thank you, Marta. So yeah, that for us is a really critical idea of thinking about the ecosystem. So one water really starts from the watershed where the water comes down to where the person is using the water, and kind of be able to think about how we manage it across that continuum is really important. I wanted to think about, I think we've laid out some of the complexities and the challenges that we all face. I wanted to move a little bit to some of the solutions, and I wanted to tee it up with a couple of things that I have heard that I think are really important in this conversation. One is, Marta, what you were saying, price, and value. Do we have the price of water right? And I would argue no. Absolutely not. Another is the kind of the management and the governance. So we've got, in the U.S., we've got 30 different agencies. In Peru, it's the same thing. How can we start to move away from that siloed approach so we can actually manage it correctly? Talala, you talked a little bit about kind of how do we think about water. You know, again, and I think the crisis and the front page headline that we're going to run out of water takes water to the front of our minds, and hopefully now that the rains have come, we don't forget that and put it back and tuck it away someplace. And kind of how do we communicate around that so we can be always conscious of water as a critical piece. But what's interesting is water can be almost like a common currency. You know, it can be the kind of, when we think about conservation, water delivers our message around climate and forests in a very effective, tangible way. If you think about health, water delivers that message of health in a very tangible way, because we can all feel it, and we all are focused on it on a very real way. So I'm gonna start with you, and I'm gonna think about this idea of price, and as you said, you like to use the idea of the arch, the time arch around that, because part of it is kind of how long, what are the time periods we need to be thinking about in terms of water quality and water security.
Thanks, Michael. So in the work of the research initiative I set up, the RISH, the Research Initiative for Cities, Health and Equity, water's a little bit like health, right? So if you speak to anyone, you don't have to be speaking to a water person the same way you don't have to speak to a health person. It's very easy to communicate the importance of health. It's very easy to communicate the importance of water. That's not the issue. The issue is who is responsible and who has the agency to act. So I think about it in terms of, you can see I have lots of heuristics, actors, agency, and accountability. Right. So who are the actors that actually should be thinking about water and should be within the context of the built environment? Because I work, well, I was saying yesterday, I think I'm the only non-water person at this table, but actually we all water people. So in the context of the built environment, who are the actors that should be sitting around the table thinking about what they do and how that impacts on water within the context of the built environment, and similarly how that impacts on health? What is the agency that they feel to act, and how accountable are they to do that? So essentially what we do is trying to look at breaking down those silos. So we've done research largely within the context of the human settlements sector, because they're responsible for, in the context of urban planning, the water, the sanitation, et cetera, to find out, well, what are the things that drive the decisions they make in how they upgrade settlements, how they maintain infrastructure beyond the building codes and beyond the rest of that. What do they think about the role that they play in water management, in health creation? What agencies they feel they have given the measures of success that are in place for them? And is there any recourse to what they do? So we know what we do impacts on health, but actually if we don't do anything about it, there's no recourse, right? There's no accountability. So really what we're trying to do is firstly trying to break those silos down, doing that two ways. So looking at the policy, from the policy environment, I think the first thing we find is that a lot of those policies are actually pulling, they're incoherent. Yeah. They're not pulling towards each other. So if we're saying we're trying to ensure that the different urban exposures focus on water, we're considering the management in the way that actually creates health, then what are the different policies that influence that? What are they doing? And one of the things that we found, certainly in Cape Town, is that they're not working. You know, a best case scenario, they're just working in isolation. Worst case scenario, they're actually pulling in different directions. And the second is around, well, especially addressing the issue of accountability. How can we use the data that is available? We always say there's no data and data is a problem because we're academics and we like to, you know, justify our existence. But in reality, there is flawed to different degrees, but there are data that are available. They largely sit within very siloed sectors. So we know that the health sector actually has quite a lot of spatial geocoded data on health outcomes and interactions with the health services. We know that the housing sector has quite a lot of information, again, spatial, on the water access, on quality and how close your water source is, etc. But they don't speak to each other. And so when you are trying to improve the access to water and you're thinking about how to manage that, there is no feedback that tells you, best case scenario, oh, actually, from what we did, this was the positive influence we had on health for the population. Firstly, because it's not on our radar from a policy perspective. Secondly, because there is no incentive to say that you know, from our sector creating health, we actually get some kind of credits, incentives in some way, and vice versa. What are the negative potential implications? There is a tendency to think about health as trickle down. We'll just do things up there and health will just trickle down and follow. That is not true. We know that if we don't consider the health implications up front and actually measure and evaluate what the impact of what we do are, we're likely to, because they are often unintended consequences to the users of the services. So one of the things that we're trying to do is essentially, more broadly, shift urban governance. More specifically, looking at integrating data systems such that we can actually work with the different people who are responsible for these health determinants. I call them health professionals. They don't call themselves that. But they are health professionals in that they're professionals whose actions impact on the population health. And look at how we can actually, so we have a couple of pilot areas, spatially join the data that are available from the different from those different sectors and importantly the downstream health indicators. Now the biggest challenge with that is not necessarily one of the biggest challenges is humans, right, and trust and sharing data. But beyond that is what you mentioned around the time arc. Because the reality is there is a period of time that we have to allow for some of these interventions to positively create to create health. But often, the time periods that public sector work towards, you know, 2-year cycles, basically, because you've got the midterm elections and then you've got the elections and you want to see things happen right. very quickly. So how can we actually, so one of the other things we're looking at in urban governance is looking at how we can actually influence those different health professionals in the city to actually, to firstly align the policies for health creation, but secondly build in that time arc in a way that allows the impact of their interventions on health to be effectively measured and for accountability to be effectively assigned.
Great. I wanted to keep in this same stream, thinking about, again, kind of how do we communicate and how do we think about this? And Radhika, you, with the work you've been doing domestically in the United States and thinking about trust, you brought this up the other evening, that, you know, we're losing trust in our water agencies. And, mm-hmm. and it's one thing to have the data, it's another thing to have the trust. Say a little bit about what we might do around that.
Yeah, and maybe I'll even loop in pricing too.
Perfect.
I mean, I think in here in this country, because I know we have folks from all over the world, all of the data shows us, right, that there is an all-time low in trust in government and in being effective, period. And then with challenges like the Flint water crisis, it has created a lack of trust in our drinking water systems, our wastewater systems. And the truth is, you know, there are communities, other communities like Flint, that don't have access to clean water, and it is a significant public health issue. But for the most part in this country, our water systems are actually an engineering marvel. And you know, if you think about, you know, the connection between water and public health, you know, one of the biggest public health achievements of the 20th century was fluoridation of drinking water and, yep. and then sanitation systems. So we've been very successful about making sure people, not all, but most people in this country have access to clean drinking water. But, you know, what the public opinion polling and data is showing now is that people are drinking bottled water at unheard of rates if you look, you know, 10 years ago. And that in particular, lower income people and communities of color because of when you see images like you have seen in Flint, Michigan. And so, you know, my organization, the water utilities all around the country are our members, these public agencies. We also have community-based organizations and farmers and, you know, sort of everyone who touches water, we try to unite them and, in common purpose. And this is a big part of what we are trying to do. How do we have people in communities on the front line who can understand what these, you know, what's safe and not safe, and be trusted messengers, because right now we have to rebuild that trust in communities. And I would say, you know, we're here with public health leaders. You all are such important messengers for this, right? Because, I mean, there's both, I mean, the all of the unintended consequences of the bottled water drink, there's plastic in that, so we're literally ingesting plastic. Poor people in communities of color who have least can afford to pay are using their precious resources on this. So I think it's something that all of us could probably get behind and work on together. You know, on the pricing issue, here in this country, and again, I don't have the international perspective, but we have sort of two wicked challenges that have come together around the value of water and how it's being priced, right? So on the one hand, I used to work for the San Francisco utility, and for most communities around the country, what it costs, not the, you know, if you take a bucket and go to the river, yes, that water is free. But if you think about what it costs to treat water, bring it to the home, take the dirty water away, you know, that costs money. And we are not pricing that. We're subsidizing that, those costs in most communities, right? So so water, the pricing of water is artificially low in most communities. At the same time, we have a new wave of organizing around the human right to water. So I live in California. In the Central Valley, with this last drought, thousands of wells have run dry. And literally in America, people do not have access to water. You know, you think about Sub-Saharan Africa, you think about America, you know, India, where I'm from. This is happening in this country too, in rural communities and Native nations, and so there is you think about the Detroit water shutoffs, where people were without water. So we have to figure out how we both make sure that our utilities and government have the resources that they need to make the investments and deliver clean water. And we have to make how to also, at the same time, have a water safety net in this country so that communities can have the ability to pay and make that fair and equitable. So it is one of the biggest dividing lines in the water policy conversation in America today.
Yeah. No, that's great. The famous line in The Graduate that the future is plastics, I think unfortunately that is the reality. We will all be embalmed as in the plastic that we're consuming. I wanted to open it up to see if there were any burning questions from the audience or any part of this conversation. Yes. Wait for the mic. Right in front here. Right here. Maybe introduce yourself first.
Hi, I'm Mohammad Sabir. I'm from Lahore, Pakistan. So my community, it is nomad and gypsies, and we have to travel around like 3 or 4 miles, especially my mother and sister and aunts, to get water. But when I go to my friends in big gated housing society, they are watering their lawns and things. Yeah. And for me, even in US, like you're talking about community of color, like even it's everywhere. So if you go to rich areas, you don't have any problem of water rationing, even in if you go to Cape Town. If you go to neighborhoods and Cape Town, especially South Africa, is interesting about its racial history. So I think like it's the rich people who need to be a little bit more cognizant of the fact that even they pay for the price of the water, they're not supposed to waste it, and they're going to share it more equitably. And I want to know, like, is there any policy which make this equity more accessible to ordinary human being, like? You say like water is for health. For me, water is for existence. And my community travels across rivers, like in Punjab, like in Indus River Valley, and like Jaffa, it's existence. Health is too light to say it. So I would like to know about that.
Let's do a couple of questions at the same time. We have the front row here all burning.
Oh, you first? Okay. The question is, I would like to hear from your experiences, what is happening within your domains to improve how we account for water use in various sectors. I'm from Zimbabwe, so I totally get what you're talking about when you talk about the crisis in Cape Town. I think you're absolutely right. Cape Town was probably the first red flag, but it is a global crisis. I work with a project called the Economics of Ecosystems and Biodiversity, TIB, so we do the kind of stuff that we're doing. I think you are also right that perhaps the solutions to this are probably outside of the medical field, although you have a role to play. And being outside of the medical field means we have to reinvent, transform the way we are doing all the accounting for ecosystem services. Water is just one. We have a looming crisis on just about any ecosystem service that you can think about. And I would like to talk to you at some point about something that we are doing in Mexico, Brazil, China, around natural capital accounting and inclusive wealth index, looking for something to augment GDP as a measure of how we are, how well we are doing as a society on economic progress. I think that's where the solution has got to be. We need to reform the whole system.
Great, great comment. A couple more here, Maxwell. That's wonderful.
Hi, my name is Tilmiza, and I'm from the Maldives. So in the Maldives, in most of the islands across the country, the freshwater lands has been contaminated because of saltwater intrusion. And we have to either rely on monsoons or rainwater harvesting or desalination plants. In Mali, per household, 10% average, about 10% of your household income is spent on water. So it's a huge percentage. But my specific question is, as Max also pointed out, it's all connected. The ecosystems are all connected. So the stress on one ecosystem has, in fact, effects all around the world. So it goes to what Sabir said also. We should be cognizant of how much water we use in the rest of the world, though we can afford to. But to Radhika, you mentioned that we are ingesting plastic when we drink water from the bottled water. So can you elaborate a little bit more? Because I know a lot of rainwater harvesting, especially after the tsunami 2004, most of the islands were donated like these big plastic containers, and we always were very skeptical about storing water in these big plastic containers, and it's out in the heat, in the sun, and then you're drinking water from these plastic containers. The other option is the well water, which is so contaminated, so pungent, that a lot of people have skin conditions. So what are the health issues related to that, and can you talk a little bit more about that?
I'll just keep it very short.
Sure.
My name is Kurat Hussain, and I'm also from Pakistan, and I work with a water resource development organization that works in arid areas of Punjab, Pakistan. So I just, I mean, it's a question in general, because after Cape Town, there is like a red flag. Pakistan is one of the 13 most water, you know, and we are going to get dry in like 20, 30 years, but we are clueless about it. And because I work for a government organization, so I just wanted to ask how to, and we have this small span, like in a year, projects close. So how do we marry this working of in within this 1 year and then coming up with something that solution are long term? Like how to go about it? Because we are policy implementers. We are not even policy makers. We just, you know, so how do we maneuver around in it? So thank you. Yeah.
So go ahead. Yeah, the consumption, how to, accountability, fire away.
Okay, so I'm going to, I'll start, should I? On the consumption issue, you remind me of a quote I read, which I'm sure you've all heard of, where it says, when you're accustomed to privilege, equality feels like oppression. And I think the conversation we need to have is that if we're talking about sustainable consumption of all these things, we have to have a conversation about what is uncomfortable. And I don't think we're there yet, because we constantly have a conversation about how to maintain where we are, but effectively manage the implications of not changing anything. So I think it's a conversation about being uncomfortable and actually making the change and absorbing that, and that it will feel, necessarily feel uncomfortable because we've been overusing, I think it was very quickly. The issue of reorganizing the system, I think, is a really vital one. We talk about the cost of action, but part of what we're looking at in terms of integrating data systems is trying to put a cost to inaction. And really, the finance, how we finance in the city, for example, how we finance different sectors is already so siloed that it's very difficult to then have this intersectoral cost of inaction. And part of what we're doing in terms of integrating those data systems is showing that, well, actually, it's the same, the system is bearing the brunt of it. It's no good saying the water sector has this amount of money and the health sector has this amount of money if one sector is increasing the cost of the other. So how do we actually show the evidence to show that we need to be thinking a little bit more differently? And bringing the sectors together is actually one of the core things that I do, and it is possible. So in the board, for example, with housing, which you mentioned you were also involved in, we've been slowly, it's slow research. We've been slowly engaging with the human settlement sector to look at incorporating health objectives into the medium-term strategic framework of the department. And we actually succeeded in doing so. And the pivot was the Minister of Human Settlements going, because we've been trying to get the attention, we have collaborators within the sector and the policy implementers say, we'll work with you, but we can't really change anything in that way. Couldn't get the attention of the minister. And then, out of the blue, we got invited to give a presentation to the minister. Why? Because he'd just come back from a meeting of ministers of housing and human settlements somewhere, I can't remember where. And his colleagues were presenting on some of the work they do. And the Minister for Housing, I don't know what the sector is called in the UK, was talking about the work they were doing with Public Health England. And he came back and says, what are we doing with public health? we should be doing something. And then someone's like, actually we are. That's how we got the change happening. So really taking
the international, you know, the South African thing and bringing it down to what you're doing. Marta, I wanted
It's also, I think what is interesting is to start breaking the problem in smaller pieces. Mm-hmm. And I think that's where we need to be very much innovators. And you said, you know, you're a policy implementer. So it's like, can we kind of drive these champions that are everywhere? Everybody kind of, you know, we have visionaries in every space and begin to say, empower them to say, we have agency, right, to figure something out. And I want to highlight some of the issues that are coming up in Peru, for example. Peru is a mining country. And the incredible thing is most of the mines are at the top of the watershed. So, for example, the Lima watershed, it begins with a huge abandoned mine at the very top. So you can imagine how everything begins. So the treatment plant, the drinking water treatment plant in Lima is probably the biggest wastewater treatment plant in the world. Okay? So the problems are huge, you know? And I think what's been interesting is to begin to say, okay, when we have situations like a mining, you know, how do we find solutions to provide? Because getting rid of the mine is not an option, politically speaking, right? So can we begin to find interesting solutions? So we have the case, for example, of Ica, where Arequipa, a city in the south, where the mining company has said, I'm going to take the wastewater and treat it, and I will pay for the treatment so that I use the refurbished water, right? I use that discharge, which is less quality water, rather than taking the water from the top of the watershed, where I'm using the nicest, best water, right, that should be given for drinking water. And that is a solution that entailed a lot of negotiation, but it ends up being cheaper and it's more effective. And those are the kind of things that we need to solve. Now, as we said, in the water space, this is all regulated to the, you know, we have 30 agencies at the federal level in the U.S. In the case of Latin America, it's a little less. But in general, it means solving the specific bottleneck that you need to solve so that the mining company can take that wastewater and be able to solve it. And I think there are many solutions like that, low-hanging fruit, that we can take. And we can begin to break the silos. We can begin to have the conversations problem by problem so that it's not this, you know, we are a huge over-regulated sector and we can't have, you know, these uncomfortable conversations. But if we're effective and innovative and begin to break it down, I think we can start getting to better pricing. And as you break the problem into pieces, because, for example, the drinking water sector is probably the smallest consumer, right? Who's the biggest consumer of water?
Agriculture.
And they're not sitting down at the table a lot of times or feel like, We're big agriculture. We don't need. But if you start working with what are the solutions that agriculture would be willing to listen to, that are in, and create those incentives, we can start breaking the problems. And they come to the table a lot of times once one sector starts to show successes, yep. And it looks more like they need to sit down yep. once they're being discussed at international events. And
just very briefly, I would
add to that. Bring us home.
Bring us home. Oh, my goodness. I mean, I like in the health sector, I think in the water sector, we have not been good at actually authentically looking at the root causes of the problems. And that's a theme that is across the four challenges. And so we need to get at those root causes and then really be big and bold in our actions. I would love to talk with you about, I mean, I think one of the bright spots of what's happening in the water sector is this approach around more integrated planning and understanding the interdependencies of the choices that we're making, that, mm-hmm. that you know, if we're depleting our aquifers, what does that mean for saltwater? I mean, this is not a conversation communities we're having, but, you know, if I look at bright spots, our member in Albuquerque, they're planning for 100 years as far as their water supply. They've done a lot of modeling. That is stuff that we could help Pakistan with, right? Just sharing of that information. Mm-hmm. In Austin, you know, Texas, big Texas, they're actually doing a 50-year plan. They're calling it Austin Water Forward because they realize that. So I think those are the yeah. things that really give me hope. I think what I have learned from even just yesterday evening and today with this panel is we actually need to build more bridges of knowledge and exchange from the United States and internationally, and to change the model of the U.S. has the answers, because we really actually don't. There's incredible innovation happening all around the country. Mm-hmm. And how do we make co-equal learning happening more intentionally at the intersection of water and health?
Yeah, absolutely.
This is Aspen Public Radio. You've been listening to a broadcast of the session Building a Water Secure Future from the Spotlight Health Conference from the Aspen Ideas Festival. You can also find this discussion in full on our website along with all of our other broadcasts and our full live broadcast schedule. Support for this broadcast of the Aspen Ideas Festival comes from Obermeyer Wood Investment Counsel, an independent investment advisor committed to helping clients navigate life's financial decisions. Learn more about the firm's team and approach at obermeyerwood.com. This is Aspen Public Radio, broadcasting on KAJX Aspen and KCJX Carbondale. Your news, your music, your station. I'm Allison Bechtesh. Thanks for listening.